feedback helps the system understand whether it's under control and satisfying the required selection tests. Balancing loops dampen each system cycle's output, leading to system equilibrium and resistance to change. Think of dropping a tennis ball from shoulder height. It'll bounce up and down, each bounce smaller than the last. Friction and air resistance dampen each cycle until the energy in the system reaches equilibrium and the ball sits at rest upon the ground. Balancing loops stabilize the system, dampening oscillations and keeping the system in a certain state. Perceptual control systems are usually made up of balancing loops. Going back to the thermostat example, if the temperature of a room is higher than the reference level, the cooling system will kick in to move the temperature lower. If the temperature is lower than the reference level, the heater will turn on to bring the temperature up. As a result, the system tends to maintain a stable temperature, which is the purpose of the system. Reinforcing loops amplify the system's output with each system cycle. Reinforcing loops tend to lead to runaway growth or decay over time. Think of a price war between two companies, each of which is competing to have the lowest price. Company A lowers its price, then company B retaliates by moving its price even lower. As long as each company's reference level stays at "our price must be lower than our competitors," prices will continue to drop until both companies eliminate their profit margins on that offering. Compounding is an example of a positive reinforcing loop. Each cycle of interest payments makes the principal of the next cycle bigger, resulting in even more interest, continuing the cycle. Over time, accumulated interest can build to enormous sums, which is the purpose of the system. More often than not, the size of every stock is influenced by several loops, all pulling it in different directions. Consider your bank account balance. There are feedback loops controlling your income, rent or mortgage, food expenditures, and other expenses. You're constantly evaluating whether each cycle is too much or not enough, which represents a balancing feedback loop. Too much or not enough inflow or outflow causes you to jump into action, which affects the next cycle. Look around you. There are feedback loops everywhere. Once you start noticing them, you'll fully appreciate the ever-changing complexity of the systems we live in. Autocatalysis. Autocatalysis is a concept that comes from chemistry. It's a reaction whose output produces the raw materials necessary for an identical reaction. An autocatalyzing system produces the inputs necessary for the next cycle as a byproduct of the previous cycle, amplifying the cycle. Autocatalysis is a compounding, positive, self-reinforcing feedback loop. The system will continue to grow until the system changes in a way that produces less output. Television advertising from the 1950s to the 1990s is an excellent example of autocatalysis. Companies could spend $1 in advertising and, via increased demand and distribution, get $2 or more in return. That $2, reinvested in advertising, became $4, which became $8, which became $16, etc. Companies like Procter & Gamble, GE, Kraft, and Nestle used this cycle to become the massive companies they are today. Now, $1 invested in television advertising is lucky to return $1.20. There are more channels, advertising is more expensive, and people have technology to filter out unwanted distractions. The loop still works in some circumstances, but it doesn't work as well as it used to. Autocatalysis doesn't always have to be money. Network effects and viral loops are also examples of autocatalysis. Every time someone signs up for Facebook, they'll naturally invite even more users to the network. Every time someone sees a funny video on YouTube, they'll pass it along to several friends. That's autocatalysis. If your business includes some autocatalyzing element, it'll grow more quickly than you expect. Environment. No system stands alone. Every system is inevitably affected by all of the other systems around it. An environment is the structure in which a system operates. The environment primarily influences or impacts the system's flows or processes, changing the output of the system. Think of how your body responds when it's either too hot or too cold. Too much or too little heat can be deadly, Your body must respond to a change in its environment to keep operating, either by sweating to shed excess heat or by sheltering to preserve it. When the environment changes, the system must change with it to continue operating. According to most leading theories, the dinosaurs became extinct because of changes in the environment, due to either an ice age or a meteorite impact that kicked up enough dust to blot out the sun. Colder temperatures and less sunlight resulted in major food shortages, resulting in mass extinction. The conditions present in the environment affect the operation of the system in that environment. In 2005, oil prices skyrocketed, and many businesses that relied on oil to manufacture plastics or transport goods suddenly ran into trouble. The increase in variable costs made many businesses less profitable than they were before, and many businesses that couldn't absorb the increase in costs closed. If you don't want to go the way of the dinosaur, you must always consider how conditions in the environment affect your system. Selection test. Self-perpetuating systems, like businesses or organisms, can only self-perpetuate as long as they meet the environmental conditions necessary to exist. A selection test is an environmental constraint that determines which systems continue to self-perpetuate and which ones die. Mammals, like humans, have several selection tests: breathing enough air, eating enough food, drinking enough water, and retaining enough heat. Businesses also have selection tests: enough value provided to customers, enough revenue to cover expenses, and enough profit to stay financially sufficient. Many people think of selection tests as survival of the fittest, but death of the unfit is a more accurate description. If a self-perpetuating system fails to satisfy a selection test, it will cease to exist. If you can't get enough air, you'll die. If your business can't bring in enough revenue to maintain sufficiency, it will die. As the environment changes, the selection tests change as well. Selection tests are particularly interesting to watch in the technology market, where the environment of what's possible changes constantly. Businesses that fail to take advantage of major changes in technology quickly find that they're unable to keep up with the new demands customers make for their products. Changing environments and selection tests are an entrepreneur's best friend. They're what allow small companies to outperform large, entrenched competitors. If you can identify what the selection tests in a market really are, you'll be able to compete in that market much more effectively. Selection tests are ruthless. Satisfy them, and you'll thrive. Fail to adapt to changing conditions, and you'll die. Uncertainty. What will interest rates look like 10 years from now? Where do you think the price of oil will be next year? How about that company stock? Is it cheap or overpriced? Is it better to stockpile raw materials now or wait a few months? Business people deal with questions like these daily. Here's the answer to all of these questions. Nobody knows. This world of ours is a tremendously uncertain place, which is both a blessing and a curse. Anything can happen, for good or ill. We simply can't know what's around the bend. There's an enormous difference between risk and uncertainty. In the immortal words of former U.S. Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld, and I quote, "There are no knowns. These are things we know that we know. There are known unknowns. That is to say, there are things we know we don't know. But there are also unknown unknowns. These are things that we don't know we don't know." End quote. Risks are known unknowns. If you're planning to pick up a friend from the airport, the probability that their flight will arrive several hours late is a risk. You know in advance that the arrival time can change, so you can plan accordingly. Uncertainties are unknown unknowns. You may be late picking up your friend from the airport because a meteorite demolishes your car an hour before you plan to leave. Who could predict that? You can't reliably predict the future based on past events in the face of uncertainty. Unexpected or random events can occur suddenly, which can have major impacts on your goals and plans. In the book The Black Swan, Nassim Nicholas Taleb, a former hedge fund manager, describes the perils of uncertainty. No matter how stable or predictable things seem, Unpredictable so-called black swan events can change everything in an instant. The term black swan was a common expression in 16th century London for something that was impossible or didn't exist. Everyone knew that all swans were white. The problem with the term is what 18th century philosopher David Hume called the problem of induction. Until you see every swan that exists, you can never assume the statement all swans are white is true. All it takes is one black swan to completely invalidate the hypothesis, which happened when black swans were documented in Australia in 1697 by a Dutch sea captain. The moment before they happen, the probability of black swan events occurring is essentially zero. In the wake of a black swan event, the probability of its occurring is a moot point. The event changes the environment in which the system operates, sometimes drastically changing selection tests without warning. You can't know in advance if or which black swan events will occur. All you can do is be flexible, prepared, and resilient enough to react appropriately if and when they do. Even the most detailed analysis with reams of historical data can't save you from uncertainty. The primary drawback of the financial models taught in most MBA programs is uncertainty. Your pro forma, net present value, or capital asset pricing model is only as good as the quality of your predictions. Many a business has been ruined by financial predictions that turned out to be wrong. How likely is it that your 10-year financial projection predicts absolutely everything that will happen with 100% accuracy? Who says tomorrow is going to be anything like today? Many people make a business of selling certainty, which doesn't exist. Prediction, forecasting, and other forms of business soothsaying are popular because they provide the illusion that the future is knowable and controllable. Exercises in prediction aren't worth the cost. If there was a foolproof way to predict gas prices, interest rates, or stock prices, the people with that magic knowledge would be enormously wealthy and would have no need to sell anything to you. Absorbing the ever-present nature of uncertainty is an exercise in seeing the world as it really is, not as we want it to be. Instinctually, we all want to feel like we know what will happen in the future, particularly given how prone we are to loss aversion and threat lockdown. Contemplating uncertainty feels bad because not knowing what's going to happen feels like a threat. Instead of fixating on predicting invisible and unknowable threats, it's better to channel your energy into enhancing your ability to handle the unexpected. Don't rely on making accurate predictions. Things can change at any time. Planning for flexibility in response to uncertainty via scenario planning is far more useful than pretending to be a seer. Change. All systems change. There is no such thing as a system in stasis. Complex systems are in a constant state of flux. There is a great deal of uncertainty in how a system will change over time, but it is certain that the system will change. Plans that do not take change into account are of limited value. Change is a fact of life. Psychologically, it's very difficult to internalize that some things are random. There's no rhyme or reason to many of the things that happen in the world. Because of our natural pattern matching abilities, we tend to see patterns where none exist and tend to attribute random changes to skill if the changes are good or misfortune if they're bad. As a result, we're fooled by randomness, the title of Nassim Nicholas Taleb's first book. You will never develop your business to the point that everything is perfect and unchanging. Many business owners and managers share an unexamined belief that by moving a business from good to great, it will be built to last, continuing to outperform competitors for decades to come. It's a pleasant dream, but measuring yourself against that yardstick is unrealistic. It requires an unchanging world. The only thing you can do about change is increase your flexibility to handle a wide variety of different circumstances. The more flexible you are, the more resilient you'll be when things inevitably change. Interdependence. Nothing in this world exists in isolation. Complex systems almost always rely on other systems in order to operate. Your refrigerator, for example, requires electricity to operate. When your local power plant fails, your refrigerator fails as well. That's interdependence. Highly interdependent systems are sometimes referred to as tightly coupled systems. The more tightly coupled the processes in a system are, the more likely failures or delays will affect other parts of the system. Tightly coupled systems are typically time-dependent, rigidly ordered, and have very little slack. There's often only one path to a successful outcome, and a failure in any part of the system can cascade to the rest of the system. If you've ever seen a Rube Goldberg machine or played with the children's board game Mousetrap, you've seen a tightly coupled system. In a cascade of dominoes, when one domino fails to knock over the next, the entire system grinds to a halt. If you've ever heard the project management term critical path, you know the importance of interdependencies. The critical path contains only the tasks that must be completed in order for the project to be finished on schedule. If something on the critical path changes, that change cascades to everything else on the path. Any delay in a task on the critical path will delay the entire project. Loosely coupled systems have low degrees of interdependence. Loosely coupled systems are more relaxed. They're typically not time dependent. You may be able to use parallel processing, completing multiple steps at a time. There's plenty of slack, and you may be able to accomplish your goal using many different strategies. Think of an orchestra, which consists of a conductor and many instrumentalists. If the first violin hits the wrong note, the quality of the performance will be affected, but the mistake won't necessarily cascade to the rest of the orchestra. You can make a system less interdependent by removing dependencies. A dependency is an input that's required before the next stage of a process can take place. The more dependencies there are in a system, the higher the likelihood of delay or system failure. Eliminating dependencies makes a system less tightly coupled. Think back to the automotive assembly line example. If you must put in an engine before the windshield is installed, an engine problem will delay the entire system. If it doesn't matter in which order the parts are installed, it's possible to assemble a finished vehicle in more than one way. In the book The 4-Hour Workweek, Timothy Ferris shares a method that made his business work far more efficiently. Initially, when a customer service representative had a problem with a customer, they were required to obtain approval from Tim before resolving it. By instituting a policy that allowed representatives to do anything necessary to solve the problems that cost less than $400 without approval, Tim made his business system less dependent upon him for operation. Eliminate unnecessary dependencies, and you'll reduce the risk of a cascading failure. Counterparty risk. If your system relies on other people in order to function, that poses a major risk to the operation of your system. Counterparty risk is the possibility that other people won't deliver what they have promised. If your house burns down, you can only make a claim on your homeowner's insurance policy if the company you purchased the insurance from is still in business. If it's not, you're in trouble. If your manufacturing system relies on a third-party vendor to supply certain parts and they're not able to honor their commitments, your manufacturing line stops. If you outsource work to a contractor and that contractor doesn't perform as promised, your project will be delayed. Too much counterparty risk increases the risk of a catastrophic system failure. In the 2008 Wall Street crash, the world's largest investment banks stood on the brink of insolvency because they all relied on one another in the event something went wrong. Investment firms and financial firms like Goldman Sachs, J.P. Morgan Chase, and Lehman Brothers made a practice of buying what are called credit default swaps, a form of financial insurance, from other large firms. If a highly leveraged deal went south, these investment banks thought the insurance they had purchased would protect them from multi-million dollar losses, so they took on more and more leverage, increasing their risk exposure. When the housing market collapsed and the banks started losing money on the mortgage securities they held, they tried calling in their credit default swaps. Lo and behold, the other banks they had purchased the swaps from had also lost a huge amount of money on mortgage-backed securities and couldn't honor the obligations. Every large investment bank was a counterparty to the risk of the other banks in the system. Because they all relied on one another, When one bank fell, they all fell. Counterparty risk is amplified by the planning fallacy. Your partners can't predict the future any more than you can, and everyone has a tendency to be optimistic regarding plans and deadlines. Make plans and commitments, but always have a plan for when the project doesn't go as expected. When your system relies on the performance of someone outside of your control, do all that you can to prepare for the possibility that they won't perform as expected. Second-order effects. A few years ago, Kelsey and I had the opportunity to visit the Kingdom of Bahrain, a small island country a few miles off the east coast of Saudi Arabia. Now known for its international banking prowess, pearl diving, and an international F1 racing track, it wasn't too long ago that Bahrain was known for its unique ecosystem. A few short decades ago, the interior of Bahrain was lush with natural greenery, and island oasis said to be the original site of the Garden of Eden. Now, the interior of the island is a stark desert, and local plant life is maintained via irrigation. What changed? Bahrain is surrounded by a network of underground freshwater springs, which were responsible for both the island's plant life and spurring the local oysters to cultivate pearls of remarkable quality. As the country's single large city, Manama, developed, land in the city center became scarce, so developers adopted a process called land reclamation, which involved excavating dirt from the interior of the island and depositing it on the coast, reclaiming land from the sea. This approach was successful in creating new land, but at a much steeper cost than anticipated. The island's network of springs dried up, turning the country into a desert. Every action has a consequence, and those consequences have consequences, which are called second-order effects. Think of a line of dominoes. A single push causes a chain of events to occur. Once the chain starts, it's difficult, if not impossible, to stop or reverse the cascade of cause and effect. Rent control in New York City after World War II is another sobering example of unintended consequences. Originally intended to provide returning veterans with affordable housing, the policy capped rent prices and the ability of landlords to raise them in certain areas of the city. Affordable housing for veterans is a noble idea, right? Here's what the city planners didn't expect. Every year, the cost to maintain properties in New York City continued to rise, but landlords couldn't raise rent prices to compensate for their increased costs. By law, rent control couldn't be removed unless the original leaseholder moved or the building was condemned, so landlords refused to maintain their property. It was a waste of money. Financially, it was better to let the building deteriorate around the remaining tenants. The effect of this policy over time was a steep decline in the quality of property, and eventually supply, as buildings were condemned, making housing even more expensive. A policy intended to make housing more affordable actually destroyed housing supply and made it more expensive, the opposite of the original intent. Changing some aspects of a complex system always introduces second-order effects, some of which may be antithetical to the original intent of the change. Elements in a complex system can be interrelated or dependent upon one another in millions of different ways, and uncertainty guarantees that you probably don't know exactly how. Every action has a consequence, and those consequences always have consequences, even if you don't know what they are or don't want them to happen. Approach making changes to a complex system with extreme caution. What you get may be the opposite of what you expect. Normal accidents. The space shuttle, a vehicle capable of exiting the bounds of Earth's gravity with human travelers aboard, is clearly an extremely complex system. A highly engineered airplane strapped to three rockets holding millions of cubic feet of explosive hydrogen gas is the epitome of a highly interdependent system. Any error has the chance of cascading catastrophically, and every time the shuttle is launched, millions of things could potentially go wrong. In 1986, the space shuttle Challenger suffered a catastrophe. A seal in one of the rockets froze, becoming extremely brittle. When the seal was superheated during takeoff, it failed. The Challenger exploded 73 seconds after liftoff, killing everyone aboard. It's tempting to believe that it's possible to create a system in which nothing ever goes wrong. Real-life systems always prove otherwise. Count on it. The theory of normal accidents is a more formal way of expressing a universal proverb: shit happens. In a tightly coupled system, small risks accumulate to the point where errors and accidents are inevitable. The larger and more complex the system, the higher the likelihood that something will eventually go very, very wrong. Overreacting to normal accidents is actually counterproductive. When something goes wrong, our instinctive response is to become hypersensitive, locking things down and adding more controls to prevent the unfortunate event from happening again. This response actually makes things worse. Locking things down and adding more systems only makes the system more tightly coupled, increasing the risk of future accidents. NASA's response to the Challenger tragedy is extremely instructive. Instead of completely shutting down or adding more systems that could compound the issue, NASA engineers recognized the inherent risk and focused on finding other solutions to the problem that would minimize the risk of the issue reoccurring without adding more systems that could potentially fail. The best way to avoid normal accidents is to analyze breakdowns or close calls when they happen. Instead of going into the system's equivalent of threat lockdown, which can create even bigger issues in the long term, looking at near misses can provide crucial insight into hidden interdependencies. By analyzing the issue, it's possible to construct contingency plans in the event a similar situation happens in the future. In 2003, the Space Shuttle Columbia suffered a catastrophe of a different sort. The carbon fiber heat shields designed to protect the shuttle as it re-entered the Earth's atmosphere failed, and the shuttle disintegrated. Again, NASA focused on how to prevent the issue from happening again without making the system even more tightly coupled. When the Space Shuttle Discovery suffered damage to its heat shields on takeoff a few years later, NASA engineers were prepared, and the crew landed safely. Normal accidents are a compelling reason to keep the systems you rely on as loose as you possibly can. There are many positive things to be said for systems, but expecting zero failures is unrealistic in the extreme. Loose systems may not be as efficient, but they last longer and fail less catastrophically. The more complex a system is and the longer it operates, the more likely it is to suffer a major failure. It's not a matter of if. It's a matter of when. Be watchful for system failure and be prepared to respond to it quickly. Chapter 10. Analyzing systems. Before you can improve a system, you must understand how well it's currently operating. Unfortunately for us, that's tricky business. It's simply not possible to stop the world however long you want while you take careful measurements. Systems must be analyzed as they're working. Analyzing a system in operation is difficult, but definitely possible, if you know what to look for. In this chapter, you'll learn how to deconstruct systems into smaller parts you can understand, measure what's important, and discover how parts of the system interact with and depend on one another to function. Deconstruction. Complex systems, as we've already discussed, are made up of many interdependent flows, stocks, processes, and parts. As a whole, the system may be too complex to take in all at once. If there are more than 7 or 8 variables or dependencies, the cognitive scope limitation kicks in and confusion takes over. If that's true, how can anyone analyze extremely complex systems? Deconstruction is the process of separating complex systems into the smallest possible subsystems in order to understand how things work. Instead of trying to understand the system all at once, you break up the system into parts, then work on understanding the subsystems and how they interact with one another. Deconstruction is the reverse engineering aspect of Gauss's law. Remember, complex systems that work inevitably evolved from simpler systems that also worked. If you can identify simpler subsystems and focus on understanding how they work and how they fit together, you can eventually understand how the entire system works. If you know nothing about how cars work, popping the hood of your vehicle and examining the contents is an exercise in confusion. There are so many parts that it's hard to know where to begin. Understanding the system is not impossible, however. Identifying important subsystems like the engine, transmission, and radiator can give you valuable insight on how the entire system functions. Once you've identified important subsystems, temporarily isolating them in your mind can help you understand how they work. Instead of focusing on how the entire car works, you simply concern yourself with the engine for a while. Where does the subsystem begin? What flows are involved? What processes take place inside the system? Are there feedback loops involved? What happens if inflows don't come in? Where does the system end? And what are the outflows? It's important not to lose sight of interdependence when using isolation to deconstruct a system, since each subsystem is part of a larger system. Identifying triggers and endpoints, the parts of the system that interact with other subsystems, is just as important. Triggers teach you what makes a subsystem start operating, and endpoints show you what makes the system stop. In addition, it's important to understand the conditionals present in a system, if-then or when-then relationships that influence the operation of the system. For example, an engine requires an inflow of gasoline vapor to operate. If that inflow is present, a spark from the spark plug ignites it, providing energy that pushes a piston that powers the rest of the system. If that inflow is absent, or a spark doesn't come from the spark plug, the energy is absent and the system stops, making both the inflow of gasoline vapor and the spark from the spark plug conditions of the system's operation. Creating diagrams and flowcharts can help you understand how each inflow, process, trigger, conditional, endpoint, and outflow comes together. Explaining complex systems in words alone can be limiting. For best results, draw diagrams of the flows, stocks, conditionals, and processes involved. Well-constructed flowcharts can help you understand the flow of the system as it operates, which can go a long way toward helping you fix the system when things break down. To analyze a system, deconstruct complex systems into subsystems that are easier to understand. Then build your understanding of the system from the ground up. Measurement. Once you've understood the parts of the system and how they interact with one another, it pays to ask another question. How well is the system operating? To do that, we rely on measuring the system as it's operating. Measurement is the process of collecting data as the system is operating. By collecting information related to the core functions of the system, it's much easier to understand exactly how well the system itself is performing. Measurement also allows systems to be compared with one another. For example, it's possible to use several different types of microprocessors to build a computer. Which one should you use? By measuring various characteristics of each processor, cycle time, power consumption, heat generation, etc., it's possible to choose the best processor for your computer, resulting in better performance. Measurement helps us avoid absence blindness when analyzing a system. Remember, we have a hard time seeing things that aren't present. Measuring different parts of a system in operation helps to identify potential issues before they arise. For example, diabetes is a condition that represents a fault in the feedback loop that controls the body's blood glucose levels. Too much or too little blood glucose is life-threatening. So if the body produces too much or too little insulin to keep blood glucose levels stable, that's a major issue. Even though insulin levels are extremely important to a person with diabetes, you can't figure out a person's insulin or blood glucose level just by looking at them. Without measurement, absence blindness is the rule until the condition becomes bad enough to become visible, which typically takes the form of a person passing out or going into shock. To avoid this situation, people with diabetes make a habit of measuring their blood glucose and insulin levels throughout the day. Measuring something is the first step to improving it. Peter Drucker famously said, "What gets measured gets managed." It's true. If you don't know how much money your business is collecting or spending, it's difficult to know whether or not any change you make to your business system is actually an improvement. If you want to lose weight, you first must know how much you weigh right now, then track how any changes you make affect your weight. Without data, you're blind. If you want to improve anything, you must measure it first. Key performance indicator. Here's the primary problem with measurement. You can measure a million different things. Measure too much, and you'll suffer from the cognitive scope limitation, drowning in a sea of meaningless data. Some measurements are more important than others. Key performance indicators, abbreviated KPI, are measurements of the critical parts of a system. Measurements that don't help you make improvements to your system are worse than worthless. They're a waste of your limited attention and energy. If your intent is to improve the system you're examining, you don't have to pay attention to everything, just a few key measurements that actually matter. Unfortunately, it's easy to fixate on things that are easy to measure instead of things that are actually important. Take, for example, a business's revenue. Seems pretty important, right? It is, but only to a point. Revenue is important only because it's a key component of profit. It doesn't matter if you collected $1 million in revenue if you spent $2 million to collect it. As Theo Paphidis, a serial entrepreneur and host of the hit BBC series Dragon's Den, memorably put it, profit is sanity. Turnover is vanity. Alone, revenue is not a KPI. The same thing goes for other in-process measurements. For example, if you're managing a team of programmers, it's tempting to measure their output in lines of code, a visible, easy-to-collect measure. Here's the problem. More code is not necessarily better. A talented programmer can make a program better by rewriting it using fewer lines of code. If you fixate on quantity, removing 10,000 lines looks like a setback, even if it's actually a huge improvement. The situation gets even worse if you reward programmers based on lines of code. Incentive-caused bias will ensure that your code looks like the programming equivalent of War and Peace. Typically, business-related KPIs are directly related to either the five parts of every business or throughput. Here are a few questions I use to identify a business's KPIs. For value creation, how quickly is the system creating value? What is the current level of inflows? For marketing, how many people are paying attention to your offer? How many prospects are giving you permission to provide more information? For sales, how many prospects are becoming paying customers? What is the average customer's lifetime value? For value delivery, how quickly can you serve each customer? What is your current returns or complaints rate? And for finance, what is your profit margin? How much purchasing power do you have? Are you financially sufficient? Any measurements directly related to these questions are probably KPIs. Anything that's not directly related to a core business process or a system's throughput is probably not. Try to limit yourself to only 3 to 5 KPIs per system. When collecting measurements, it's tempting to build yourself a so-called dashboard that contains every piece of information you'd ever want to see. Resist the temptation. If you overload yourself with too much data, you'll be far less likely to see changes that are critically important. You can always dig deeper into the data at your disposal if necessary. Find your system's KPIs, and you'll be able to manage your system without drowning in data. Garbage in, garbage out. If you analyze poor quality data, the resulting analysis will be worthless at best and misleading or damaging at worst. The quality of the input you use always has an impact on the quality of the output. If you build an object from poor quality materials, that object will be unattractive and unreliable. If you eat a lot of junk food, don't move around much, and pay attention to too much news and reality TV, you'll feel apathetic instead of energetic. If the people working on a project aren't skilled or excited, the end result will suffer. Garbage in, garbage out is a straightforward principle. Put useless input into a system, and you'll get useless output. Your ability to understand a system is directly related to your ability to observe what's going on in that system. The quality and quantity of the data you collect about the system represents an upper limit to how well you'll be able to understand what's happening in the system as it's operating. If you don't want garbage when you're done, don't use garbage when you begin. Being mindful of what you're starting with can help you ensure that the end result of the process meets your expectations. To improve your results, improve the quality of what you start with. Tolerance. Many inexperienced business people expect perfection. Any sort of mistake or variance, however small, is a cause for concern. Take, for example, a business's website. Most business people are aghast when their website goes down, an event that prompts concern calls to the system administrator or responsible party. Often the words, "Make sure our website never goes down," are spoken. That's not realistic. Perfection is impossible. 100% reliability is a pipe dream. Normal accidents are a fact of life, so it pays to account for them in planning. The more reliability you need, the more your system is going to cost. A tolerance is an acceptable level of normal error in a system. Within a given range of measurements, the system is performing as intended. As long as errors don't exceed a certain threshold, urgent intervention is not required. Tolerances are often referred to as being tight or loose. A tight tolerance is one in which there's little room for error or variability, which is common if the component or system is critical to the performance of the entire system. A loose tolerance allows significant room for error or variability and is common when small mistakes produce no major repercussions. The reliability of a system is often measured in terms of a percentage. When a system is 95% reliable in a given area, it will produce a result within the intended tolerances 19 out of 20 times. The higher the reliability, the higher the percentage. When you hear someone talk about so-called 5-9s reliability, that means the system produces the intended result 99.99999% of the time. This level of reliability is extremely impressive and just as expensive to achieve. Systems companies often use this reliability measurement as a tolerance, and they write a contract called a Service Level Agreement, or SLA, that promises to compensate customers if errors exceed a certain threshold. Tight tolerances are very useful and a positive indicator of quality. After all, you don't want mistakes or variations. Work to achieve tighter tolerances for the critical parts of your system over time. Analytical honesty. My last position at Procter & Gamble involved creating an online marketing measurement strategy, figuring out a way to measure the effectiveness of P&G's advertising on the web. P&G spent millions of dollars every year on banner ads, search engine advertising, and online video placements. My job was to figure out if the investment was worth it. One of the things my team discovered while putting together our recommendations was disturbing. The system we were using on most of our websites to measure unique visitors was wrong. Instead of simply counting human visitors, the system was treating visits from search engine programs as visitors as well, even though they weren't people. Computer programs don't care about laundry detergent and shampoo, but the system was counting them as potential customers. It's not uncommon for search engine spider programs to visit a website many times a day looking for information, so the system was overstating how many people were visiting each website by a significant margin. Put simply, it was a garbage-in, garbage-out situation, and it made our measurements much less useful. Naturally, we recommended upgrading the tracking system to collect visitor data more accurately. Almost universally, the teams declined. They knew they were getting crappy data, but they didn't seem to care. Weird, right? Here's the rub. Installing the new tracking system would make each website's unique visitors measurement, considered a key performance indicator by most teams, go down dramatically. Even though the new system was clearly more accurate, installing it would make the team look bad. Instead of correcting the issue, they chose to continue living a lie. As a result, they seriously compromised their ability to improve their website's actual performance. Analytical honesty means measuring and analyzing the data you have dispassionately. Since humans are social creatures, we tend to care deeply about how others perceive us, which gives us a natural incentive to make things look better than they actually are. If your purpose is to actually make things better, this tendency can get in the way of collecting accurate data and conducting useful analysis. The best way to maintain analytical honesty is to have your measurements evaluated by someone who isn't personally invested in your system. Incentive-caused bias and confirmation bias are all too easy to succumb to if your social status is on the line. Having an experienced but dispassionate third party audit your measurement and analysis practices is a neat workaround for these tendencies. You might not like what you hear, but at least you'll be fully aware of potential issues. Don't look at your data through rose-colored glasses. Always strive to be honest with yourself about what the data indicates you can improve. Context. You brought in $200,000 of revenue this month. Is that good or bad? It depends. If you brought in $100,000 last month, it's good. If your expenses are $400,000 this month, it's bad. Context is the use of related measurements to provide additional information about the data you're examining. In the example above, knowing your revenue isn't very useful without additional information. Knowing last month's revenue and this month's expenses provides necessary context, giving you a clearer picture of the situation. Aggregate measurements almost never tell you anything useful. Aggregate measurements are worthless when it comes to making tangible improvements because they lack context. Knowing 2 million people visited your website this month tells you absolutely nothing useful. Without context, you can't determine change or effectiveness, which limits your ability to improve the system. Try to avoid the temptation to focus on a single magic number when tracking your results. Relying on a single number sounds like a useful simplification, but it's not. Removing context blinds you to important changes in the data. Knowing your so-called total quality score, or that revenue went up or down a few points, won't tell you why it happened, whether or not it's important, or if it's due to random fluctuations or a significant change in the system or its environment. As a general rule, examine no measurements in isolation. Always look at them in context with other measurements. Sampling. What do you do if your system is too large or complex to collect data on every process? Sometimes it's not practical to measure the flows of an entire system. If you're managing a scalable system, it's often not possible to test every unit or find every error. How can you identify potential problems quickly when your system is cranking out millions of units or completing millions of transactions? Sampling is the process of taking at random a small percentage of the total output, then using it as a proxy for the entire system. If you've ever had your blood taken at the doctor's office, you'll have a good idea of what sampling entails. The doctor or nurse draws a small amount of blood, which is sent to a laboratory for analysis. If testing reveals anomalies in the sample, it's likely that the same issue is present in the bloodstream in general. Sampling can help you identify systemic errors quickly without testing all of the output of the system, which can be time-consuming and expensive. If you're manufacturing mobile phones, you don't have to test every single phone that comes off the line. If you test 1 in 20 phones, you can still identify errors quickly enough to fix the system if something goes wrong. Depending on how quickly and accurately you need to spot errors, you can increase or decrease the sampling rate. Random spot checks are also a form of sampling. Many retail stores employ secret shoppers to periodically test customer service or the skills of their sales staff. These shoppers are hired to express interest in specific items, ask certain questions, make a return, or generally be annoying. Since the staff doesn't know which customers are real and which ones are not, it's an effective way for the management of a store to test their staff without scrutinizing them every second of every day. Sampling is prone to bias if the sample is not truly random or uniform. For example, measuring the average household income in the United States by surveying property owners in Manhattan will skew the data considerably higher than if you survey property owners in West Virginia. For best results, use the largest random sample you possibly can. If you need to test for quality, sampling can help you collect good data without incurring enormous costs, provided you stay on the lookout for potential bias that can skew your data. Margin of error. Suppose you purchase a trick coin from a magician shop, and you want to make sure the coin is actually biased to land on heads most of the time. How can you be sure you didn't buy a dud? You start flipping the coin, of course. Let's assume that in the first five flips, you get two heads and three tails. Should you ask for a refund? It's probably worthwhile to make sure your results are accurate before jeopardizing the magician's good name. Margin of error is an estimate of how much you can trust your conclusions from a given set of observed samples. Since you only flipped the coin five times, you can't be absolutely sure it's a dud. Your sample size is very small. Each coin flip makes your sample size larger. If you go on to flip the coin 1,000 times and it comes up tails 2/3 of the time, you can be relatively sure that the coin is biased, but not in the way you expected. Since a non-loaded coin should come up heads half the time, your large sample size makes it likely the magician gave you a tails-loaded coin by mistake. Each additional sample you make increases your available data and helps ensure your set of observed samples is representative of the general population you're studying. The more samples you take, the lower your margin of error becomes, and the more faith you can have in the conclusions you make from examining the samples as a whole. Unavoidable biases in sampling can be accounted for by increasing your margin of error. The math behind how to estimate margin of error is beyond the scope of this book. It's relatively easy once you get the hang of it, particularly if you use a spreadsheet or database for your analysis. If you need to calculate margin of error or other related estimates like confidence intervals or credibility intervals, I recommend picking up the book Principles of Statistics by M.G. Balmer for an in-depth tutorial. In general, beware of misleading conclusions based on small and/or non-representative sample sizes. Whenever you're presented with an average or a probability based on data you're not familiar with, it always pays to investigate the size of the sample and how it was collected. Sample sets that are too small or biased can significantly influence the final analysis. When it comes to analytical confidence, more data is always better. Collect the largest set of samples you can. Ratio. A ratio is a method of comparing two measurements against each other. By dividing your results by your input, you can measure all sorts of useful relationships between different parts of your system. For example, assume that for every 30 customers who enter your store, 10 of them make a purchase. Your closing ratio would be 10 divided by 30, 1/3. Let's say you train your sales staff in techniques that result in 15 paying customers out of 30 who enter the store. Your new closing ratio is 15 divided by 30, 1/2. Percentages are simply ratios with a base of 100. Your first closing ratio, converted into a percentage, is 33%. Your second would be 50%. Here are some useful ratios to track. Return on promotion. For every $1 you spend in advertising, how much revenue do you collect? Profit per employee. For every person you employ, how much profit does your business generate? Closing ratio. For every prospect you serve, how many purchase? Returns or complaints ratio. For every sale you make, how many choose to return or complain? Financial ratios are very helpful when examining financial statements. Ratios like return on investment, return on assets, return on capital, inventory turns, and day sales outstanding are very useful in determining the health of a business. For a full introduction to common financial ratios, I recommend the book Financial Intelligence for Entrepreneurs by Karen Berman and Joan Knight. Tracking ratios over time can provide a directional indication of how a system is changing. If your closing ratio or return on investment keeps going up, that's a good thing. If it's going down over time, it would pay to investigate to find out why. Be creative. Study your business, then construct ratios that highlight the most important parts of your system. Typicality. The average household net worth of a person who reads the Wall Street Journal is $1.7 million. Seems that Wall Street Journal readers are extremely well off, right? Yes, but less than you think. Bill Gates and Warren Buffett read the Wall Street Journal, and their wealth is measured in the billions, significantly more than even the top 0.01% of business professionals. Simply by existing, high net worth executives like Gates and Buffett skew the average much higher than it would be otherwise. If you're relying on the average to tell you how much the typical Wall Street Journal reader is worth, you are making a mistake. Many forms of analysis rely on defining typicality, identifying a normal or typical value for some important measurement. There are four common methods of calculating a typical value: mean, median, mode, and mid-range. A mean, or average, is calculated by adding the quantities of all data points, then dividing by the total number of data points available. Averages are simple to calculate, but are prone to Gates and Buffett syndrome, the presence of outliers that skew the average too high or low to be representative. Exclude the outliers, however, and the average becomes more accurate. A median is calculated by sorting the values in order of high to low, then finding the quantity of the data point in the middle of the range. Medians are actually a specific form of analysis called a percentile. The median is the value that expresses the 50th percentile. By definition, 50% of the values in the set will be below the median. Calculating the median and comparing it to the mean can tell you if the average is being influenced by a few heavy hitters. A mode is the value that occurs most frequently in a set of data. Modes are useful for finding clusters of data. A set can have multiple modes, which can alert you to potentially interesting interdependencies in the system that produced that data. A mid-range is the value halfway between the highest and lowest data points in a set of values. To calculate the mid-range, add the highest and lowest values, then divide by 2. Mid-ranges are best used for quick estimates. They're fast, and you only need to know 2 data points, but they can be easily skewed by outliers that are abnormally high or low, like Bill Gates's bank balance. Means, medians, modes, and mid-ranges are useful tools that can indicate typical results, provided you're careful enough to use the right tool for the job. Correlation and causation. Imagine a billiards table. If you know the exact position of every ball on the table and the details of the forces applied to the cue ball, like impact vector, impact force, location of impact, table friction, and air resistance, you can calculate exactly how the cue ball will travel and how it will affect other balls it hits along the way. Professional billiards players are skilled at mentally simulating these relationships so well they can rapidly clear entire tables. That's causation, a complete chain of cause and effect. Since it's possible to calculate a complete chain of causality, you can say that striking the cue ball caused another ball to fall into the corner pocket. If you hit the cue again in exactly the same way, in exactly the same situation, you'll get the same result every single time. Here's another thought experiment using hypothetical data. People who suffer heart attacks eat, on average, 57 bacon double cheeseburgers every year. Does eating bacon double cheeseburgers cause heart attacks? Not necessarily. People who suffer heart attacks typically take 365 showers a year and blink their eyes 5.6 million times a year. Do taking showers and blinking your eyes cause heart attacks as well? Correlation is not causation. Even if you notice that one measurement is highly associated with another, that does not prove that one thing caused the other. Imagine you own a pizza parlor and you create a 30-second advertisement to air on local television. Shortly after the commercial goes live, you notice a 30% increase in sales. Did the advertisement cause the increase? Not necessarily. The increase could be due to any number of factors. Maybe a convention was held in town that day, so there were more visitors in town than usual, and they needed a quick place to eat. Maybe school let out and families went out to eat to celebrate. Maybe you offered a special 2 pizzas for the price of 1 promotion at the same time, and that's what actually brought more people in the door. So many things happen at the same time, it's hard to be certain. In fact, the commercial may have actually caused a decline in sales. Maybe people found it unappealing or offensive, but another factor caused such a huge increase in sales that it overshadowed the decline. Causation is always more difficult to prove than correlation. When analyzing complex systems with many variables and interdependencies, it's often extremely difficult to find true causality. The more changes that happen in a system over a period of time, the higher the likelihood that more than one change had an impact on the result you're trying to analyze. Adjusting for known variables can help you isolate the potential causes of a change in your system. For example, if you know that families go out to celebrate the end of school or that an annual convention is coming up, you can adjust for that seasonality by using historical data. The more you can isolate the change you made from the system from other factors, the more confidence you can have that the change you made intentionally actually caused the results you see. Norms. If you want to compare the effectiveness of something in the present, it's often useful to learn from the past. Norms are measurements that use historical data as a tool to provide context for current measurements. For example, by looking at past data, you may discover trends in your sales data directly related to the date the sale was made, which is called seasonality. Seasonality is a good example of why norms are often useful. If you're in the business of selling Christmas ornaments, comparing sales during the fourth quarter, October through December, to third quarter sales, August through September, probably isn't useful. No one purchases Christmas ornaments in August. Far better to compare this year's fourth quarter sales with last year's fourth quarter sales to see if you performed better than last year's comparable period. When measurement practices change, norms based on the previous measurements are no longer valid. At P&G, we had a method of evaluating the effectiveness of certain types of advertising. Drawing on several years' worth of data, it was possible to compare new advertisements with old advertisements that had been successful. If the new advertising didn't beat the norm in testing, it wasn't used. If the company suddenly decided to use a different testing methodology, the norms would no longer be valid. It would be comparing apples and oranges. Change the measurement methods, and you immediately invalidate any norms based on them. If you still want to use norms, you must build your database of historical information once again. Past performance is no guarantee of future performance. Remember, we're dealing with complex systems. Things always change over time. Just because something was useful in the past does not mean it will continue to perform as well in perpetuity. For best results, re-examine your norms periodically to make sure they're still valid. Proxy. What do you do if it's not possible to measure something directly? A proxy measures one quantity by measuring something else. For example, in democratic political systems, votes are used as a proxy to measure the will of the people. It's not possible to subject every citizen in the country to a brain scan that reveals detailed preferences, so votes are used as the next best alternative. Proxies are used all the time in scientific measurement. Ever wonder how scientists know how hot the sun is, or how old certain rocks are? They measure proxies, like the wavelength of electromagnetic rays or the decay of known radioactive isotopes, then apply well-proven relationships and formulas to determine the answer. Useful proxies are closely related to the primary subject. The closer, the better. Take website analytics. You may want to know exactly where and how long people pay attention to different parts of the web page, but again, you can't brain scan each visitor to your website. Tracking the position of the mouse cursor, however, can be a useful proxy for attention. According to a study done by researchers at Carnegie Mellon University, and I quote, 84% of the times that a region was visited by a mouse cursor, it was also visited by a user's eye gaze. In addition, 88% of regions that were not gazed by the eye were also not visited by the mouse cursor, end quote. Because mouse movements and eye fixation, that is, attention, are highly correlated, mouse movements are a pretty good proxy for visitor attention. The better the correlation, the better the proxy. For best results, ensure that the proxy is actually related to the intended subject. Proxies can be tricky or misleading if they seem to measure one thing but actually measure another. Think back to the example of trying to measure programmer productivity by counting lines of code as a key performance indicator. As we discussed,